Goedenavond, beste luisteraars. Ik heb een opdracht gekregen van het politbureau van Radio Centraal. Waarschijnlijk omdat ik een Rus ben. Je bent toch geen Rus als je geen strafstudie krijgt van het politbureau. In die opdracht werd mij gevraagd om een interview te nemen van een Russische academicus en journalist, Kirill Filimonov. Deze man heeft juist een thesis geschreven over alternatieve media. En alternatieve media is iets wat Radio Centraal volledig achter staat, voor geheel mij onverklaarbare redenen. En daarom moeten wij daar toch wel even over hebben. Nu om even kort te schetsen. Kirill Filimonov schreef die thesis in Zweden aan de Uppsala School van Studies in Media and Communication. En zijn thesis noemt The Performance of Participation in Russian Alternative Media. Dat is de hoofdtitel. De kleine titel is Discourse, Materiality and Effect in Grassroots Media Production in Contemporary Russia. Dus u voelt het al, grappen. Oh, wat gaan we lachen, het zijn allemaal lichte onderwerpen. Kirill is een zeer erudiet man en dat kunt u uit de thesis duidelijk snel opvangen. Hij gaat op het concept van alternatieve media vanuit de perspectief van poststructuralisme en discourstheorie. Hij maakt alle soorten aantekeningen erbij over de filosofische aspecten van taal en hoe taal kan gebruikt worden. En dus jij kunt misschien stellen, het is een zwaar beladen tekst, textueel zeker en vast. Voor de mensen die zich daar interesseren, dan kan ik u gewoon naar de thesis zelf doorverwijzen. De link daarvan kunt u waarschijnlijk op de website van Radio Centraal terugvinden. Wat voor mij ook interessant was, voor iemand die zelf van Russische afkomst is, is eigenlijk de politieke situatie van die drie groepen dat hij in de thesis bespreekt. Uiteraard stel ik hem ook daar vragen over. Wat ik bijvoorbeeld niet wist, en toch interessant weet je, is dat je krijgt een boete in Rusland om te gaan demonstreren. En deze kan ergens tussen 100.000 en 300.000 roebel zijn. Nu, je denkt bij wijze, 300.000 roebel, dat is waarschijnlijk 2,5 euro. Daar kun je geen pintje mee kopen. Dat is niet waar. De boetes die liggen dus tussen 1000 euro en 3500 euro voor gewoon ergens te zijn op straat en niemand zeer te doen. Dus u kunt begrijpen dat de politieke tegenstander in Rusland heel zwaar wordt onderdrukt al jaren. En dat, laten we zeggen, wij underground politieke tegenstanders uitgeschakeld worden. Uiteraard, de grootste tegenstander op dit moment in Rusland is Alexei Navalny. Daar heb ik het ook over met Kirill. Ik ga niet verder daarover uitweiden. Het was een zeer interessant gesprek. Ik ben heel blij dat ik de kans heb gekregen om met de man te spreken. En voor de mensen die zich interesseren in de onderwerpen van dit thesis, dan stel ik echt voor om het gewoon een keertje zelf te lezen. Indien u 5 uur te veel tijd hebt. Want het zijn meer dan 200 pagina's. En ik lees traag. Dat gezegd zijnde, ik kan niet verder uitweiden. Hier is voor jullie met veel plezier Kirill Filimonov.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this program. Today with us we have Kirill Filimonov, who wrote a dissertation about alternative media in Russia. That dissertation covers a lot of different aspects of participative media and participation in general. But however, I think that I should have a better chance explaining it if I give words to Kirill himself. Kirill, welcome.
Hi, Sergey. Thank you for having me. Indeed, this is a dissertation about participatory media in Russia. And I think there are two stories that are of interest in this respect. And the first one is general, about participatory media in general and what kind of discussions we're having in journalism. And the second one is more specific about Russia. But let's start with this order. So yes. The journalist part is the one that speaks to, I think, a lot of concerns that journalists, media producers, and those people who produce media in general have in relation to journalism. And that is that journalists have taken a rather elitist position in relation to their audience. The audience has few ways of meaningfully interacting with journalists and with the media, except for, you know, a rather trivial position of the audience of the, you know, ordinary people, and the other positions in which we usually see the vox pop. So it especially and disproportionately affects the people from marginalized communities who are not really controlling the ways in which they're represented in mainstream media. So this is, of course, a long-lasting discussion. Unfortunately, the media have not done a great service to this cause in the past years and perhaps even decades. So on the one hand, I'm dealing precisely with the media outlets that are reclaiming this right to represent themselves, but also to do this in a much more inclusive way, in a way where horizontality is the main driving principle of self-organization, and where the media production is available to non-media professionals, to people without, say, journalistic education, without specific journalistic practice. Of course, the media professionals are not completely excluded from the picture, but it is not a prerequisite to be a professional journalist to enter the picture. And, you know, I have a journalistic education myself, which my bachelor was in journalism back in Russia. I know very well the discourse around this, like how important professional skills are, how exclusionary these practices are, and how we don't want to see people who are not journalists producing media. And I think that is a very crucial part in what I was doing. So I was indeed looking at the three communities, one anarchist community, one student community, and one broadly kind of artistic activist community, looking at how they try to sort of overcome this internal hierarchies, internal structures, and produce something that speaks to their community cause. So that's the first part.
Yes. You mentioned working with those three different groups. You worked with them also within in Russia itself. I suppose that their position in current day Russia is heavily compromised by their antagonism by the state. So they don't find themselves in a, I would say, a safe position from a journalist's point of view. How did you experience that while working with them? Did you feel a certain pressure coming from the outside, from the state, certain fear? What was the experience like for you?
I think this is a very interesting part, right? The Russian part, the specifically Russian part in this research. Of course, Russia is a very specific context with a very strong state that exercises its power. You know, we know the mainstream narrative around it, of course, and the media freedom is limited in many, many different ways. So this is a very interesting part of the study, I think, because it is uniquely Russian. And on the one hand, what I think is so interesting in dealing with these communities and looking at this kind of lower levels of media production, of resistance, you could say, is precisely that life is much more colorful, right, than what we often hear in relation to Russia, where we often hear, you know, this mainstream Western narrative, of course, that there is Putin and there's the opposition, and perhaps we know, you know, a couple of names in the Russian politics, and that's about it, right? And indeed, the institutional politics in Russia are half-existing, extremely boring, and of course, the power struggles are not really happening on the level of institutions, right? And on the level of, say, parliamentary institutions. But what's so interesting is looking precisely at this at these lower levels, at these activist milieus, which I was trying to do, and seeing what the state really means for them, and what having their voice heard means for them, right? And so this is looking at this very, very non-institutional, very hidden part was very much the purpose of this study. And of course, to answer your question, the state was very much present in the picture, especially in the anarchist community. The fear for you know, their own security was very much there, and there were good reasons for that. The anarchists in Russia in the past few years have been experiencing arrests. They even claimed tortures, and you know, they were jailed. So in that sense, especially in those more radical activist groups, the concern is very much present. But on the other hand, you know, for example, discourse, this, as I said, broadly political, activist, artistic community was rather relaxed. And as long as you don't experience this direct, I would say it's the point where you actually face arrests and convictions. This is where the game really changes, right? Mm-hmm. And you could see this very, I think, acutely with Doxa, this student community I'm working with, which actually, as we speak right now, are very much in peril. Four editors of Doxa had their houses searched, and they basically were put under house arrests just in April this year for sort of, you know, for a criminal case started against them. It's a long story.
If I might interrupt, what kind of criminal charges does the state try to bring up against self-proclaimed journalists like those guys? Are they criticizing the state openly, giving the state a chance to sue them by that? Or is it the suspicion by the state that they might criticize that's enough for them to be persecuted?
So this particular case with Doxa was to some extent rather absurd, I would say, because what they were accused of was involving the minors in illegal activities, basically. Mm-hmm. There was a video clip where the Doxa editors were explaining to teenagers that it's okay for them to participate in political protests in support of Alexei Navalny in that case. Mm-hmm. So, and that is a criminal offense in Russia. It's called involving minors in hazardous activities. And so now they are basically awaiting a trial. They are under house arrest. So could they really foresee a criminal charge doing that video? I'm not sure. So in that sense, of course, you are, you know, it's a minefield in a way, and you never know exactly where you will step and what will happen. So the state feels this these attacks, and as long as you try to foster an alternative kind of discourse, the state will react. And I think this is very much what happened here. Even going back to my point about the non-institutional spaces where political participation is happening in Russia, right? Very much what I studied. I think it's precisely the idea of this cozy parallel world to the state, where the state will not reach us, which is so seductive for these communities. Like, well, we'll actually know. They were considering renting apartments just for their communities, organizing the space on their own, really sort of living these principles that they preach, such as horizontality and democracy, the very promise of creating and fostering these alternative spaces where the state would not enter was very much a driving force behind their activities.
Yeah.
And of course, this was all supported by friendships and, hanging out, actually having beers. Resistance to the state as such is not really, I would argue, the driving force forward of what they're doing. But it's very much the sociality around it and the ability to do something different. But the state does respond. Let's make no mistake, right? And we see that also in what is happening now. So these parallel worlds are very short-lived in Russia.
You mentioned the fact that they were basically accused of turning over, sort of speak, minors. And there's something that you also put down in your dissertation, which I found very interesting, is the fact that there's a certain divide, a generational divide, between the young generation, which seems to be more urban and more internet savvy, than the older generation, which gets all of its news from the classical media, so television and radio, which is predominantly state-owned. How did you experience that divide while working with those groups?
The three communities were a bit different in terms of how long they've been out there on this stage. So Autonomous, this anarchist community in my study, was, for instance, the first anarchist magazine that ever appeared in the modern Russia in the mid-90s. Was the first issue was published. So the other two communities are rather recent, 2015, 2017, respectively. So the student community Doxa only really popped up 4 years ago and actually came to prominence, I would say, 2 years ago. So you can also see this in terms of how what the pool of participants are, and how and to what extent they are actually included in this participatory activities. And you mainly see, I would argue, people, of course, in their 20s, mostly involved in this very direct sort of direct action. And because, as I said, sociality and friendships and hanging out is so central to these communities, you mainly do that before you get your families, and most of them, later in their life do get families. So on the one hand, there is that part. On the other hand, of course, there's this old discussion about the divide. On the other hand, this is a very urban environment as well. So the action that I was I was looking at, and I spent a lot of time in the field, was mainly taking place in cities. And of course, in Russia, the cities means, you know, the city of Moscow was the center stage of what was going on. So we are not really talking about the country as a whole. This is this, you know, active minority that is centered in cities, in Moscow specifically, and the old discussion about the rural versus urban divide in Russia, I think, is still rather pertinent to this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Also, in your dissertation, you, of course, take the example of the representative model of democracy. However, last time we've talked, you mentioned that Russia could be best described as a hybrid state. Could you elaborate on that, please?
The hybrid state, the hybrid regime is the fashionable expression to describe Russia's political system, where democratic institutions still exist. There is still the parliament, there is still the court, but they're completely hollowed out of their meaning. So the parliament is in a more or less complete control of the executive. The courts, issue verdicts that are 99% of which are accusatory. So there is this resemblance of a system which is sort of a Western and democratic, but in fact it is not. So that is more or less what we mean when we say the hybrid regime.
Mm-hmm. Also, you were talking about the difference between, say, liberal minimalism and a pluralist version of democracy. What did you exactly mean by that? That was kind of unclear to me within the Russian context.
So I think one of the central issues that this work is trying to bring up is to what extent it actually is important to focus on institutions only, including the institutions of representative democracy. And of course, Russia is not Belgium. It's not Sweden, where I was conducting this research. Institutions matter to a much lesser extent in Russia, and especially democratic institutions, as I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Still, there is an issue that is, I think, universal to these different contexts, where we tend to overemphasize sometimes the importance of institutions for a well-functioning democracy. What I was trying to show in this work, and what a lot of theories within this discussion on direct democracy versus representative democracies talk about, is the importance of looking beyond, political parties, beyond elections, in trying to understand where else democracy can work. And here we often hear the argument that the democracy is actually performed on many different levels of society. It also matters how we structure our families. It matters how we structure our workplaces, how we structure our communities and power relations in these communities. So this thesis is addressing one specific area, which is the media production of journalism, where power relations are still rather, rather hierarchical, where the editors still have a lot of power, and where, low level producers are often not really having a lot of say in deciding on what content will be published and in what form it will be published. So that's very much what this work was about.
All right. Of course, you mentioned the underground character of your thesis and, of course, of those three groups that you've mentioned. Last time that we've talked, you also mentioned the meetings, because those three groups had different, proceedings of how to decide on what's going to be there, the editorial pieces. Which one of those did you find to be the most interesting? Maybe not democratically speaking, but just from an anthropological point of view. Which was the most interesting way of working from those groups?
I'm really glad you asked this question, because that's actually, if we are to ask the question, what makes them participatory, this is exactly what this question relates to, right? So discourse, I think, was the medium that had the most elaborate procedure of deciding on the incoming content. Mm-hmm. So the way that community was deciding on what to publish and what not to publish was to have a community of authors. They were about 450 people at the time when I was doing my guild work. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that have at least once published with Discourse. So they then automatically become part of this community of authors. And whoever submits their text to this platform is being subjected to the procedure of voting by this entire community of authors. So 450 people have the right to decide, right? The incoming content in favor or against. So if a certain text receives more than 20% dislikes, kind of, or, you know, disapproval rate would be more than 20%, it gets rejected. So it doesn't really matter how many people will vote, but, you know, the proportion of yes and no does matter. And of course, what's interesting is that when people get the opportunity to actually vote, do they do that, right? It's the matter of a turnout then. And of course, you don't really get 450 votes, or you don't get 400 votes, you never even get 100 votes. So what's the interesting dynamic that then opens up is that, okay, once you have that democratic procedure and democratic right, how do you use it? Do you use it at all? And I think that was the main issue. But the very, you know, the mechanism was there, the technological infrastructure for that was there, and I thought it was quite an impressive way.
All right. Another question, of course, is someone you've already mentioned, person which cannot be overlooked at this moment in Russian politics, is, of course, Navalny, who has just recently took a turn for the worse within jail, so he needs direct medical assistance. And, of course, from a humanitarian point of view, that is the most important thing right now. However, in the West, many people were turned off by the fact that he comes from a right-wing space. When he started his career, he had some very right-wing points. Now, last time you've mentioned that he used to run as a for mayor in Moscow, and he had some points there. How did you see his career develop? Because I've understood that you followed him for some time. Where do we have to stand on the whole Navalny phenomenon?
As you mentioned right now, I think it's extremely difficult to meaningfully comment on Navalny's political views because the situation is so dire that the entire subject has really overstepped this right-left kind of divide, right? And it is a very much of an ethical discussion at this point. The man is dying, basically, right? So so the right now, I think, interestingly, the voices that were pointing at his right-wingness have also calmed down, it seems. At least I have not seen a lot in that respect yet. So, of course, we'll see how the situation develops, and we hope for the best, and we wish him best. In terms of his development and his political views, I think you can see a few turning points in that political career. The entire right-wing background really comes from the, I believe, mid-noughties or the end of noughties, where he was actively flirting with the nationalists and participating in this so-called Day of National Unity on the 4th of November, where the nationalists would traditionally, at that time, march in the outskirts of Moscow. Navalny would join them. Navalny would actually be actively showing his interest in that movement. And there, of course, you had a lot of extremely racist and xenophobic opinions being expressed. Navalny did not express them directly, arguably, but he was still among them. He showed his active, again, interest in what they were doing and what they were saying. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people argued back then that Navalny is simply trying to sort of, you know, get them to the table and talk to them because they're also the citizens of this country. But, you know, it did not make a great impression on a lot of people and a lot of moderate people, especially on the progressive wing. Mm-hmm. The next point was 2013, and that is when Navalny was running for the position of the mayor of Moscow. And that campaign was interestingly xenophobic, and I actually got to cover it myself. And I do remember writing this piece on the rather acutely sort of anti-migrant statements that he was doing, claiming, among other things, that sort of half of the male population of Tajikistan are working in Moscow as, you know, as migrant workers, mm-hmm. and that needs to be stopped, and that the visa regime needs to be introduced on the border between Russia and the Central Asian republics, which of course means Kazakhstan mostly. So there were these things being said. That Navalny in that election performed extremely well, actually. He got about a third of the vote. So he was never allowed to run in elections since that time because mm-hmm. you could really see what the guy can do. And the result was impressive. But since then, we did not really hear that much of nationalistic statements expressed by Navalny. And God knows what happened exactly and what kind of calculation was behind that. But he really then drifted much more to the center. And since that time, he tried to be much more careful with what he was expressing. And of course, now again, he is sort of beyond politics in the narrow sense, right? Right now, especially since his poisoning and his return to Russia from Germany, I think he's much more of a sort of almost, you know, kind of national hero for a lot of people who don't mm-hmm. see him as a kind of ideological or political figure anymore.
Yeah, I find it to be a very interesting transposition that you just mentioned, that basically from a man who started off spreading what could be described as fake news. There's the thing about the half of the male population of Tajikistan working in Moscow, that he turned out to be the guy who is the most fervent opposer of fake news in Russia, as he exposed so many things wrong with the state, the corruption, which is very much present in every layer of society, and on which he did lots of films. Do you see a certain change within the Russian population by everything he did? How do Russians perceive this fake news phenomenon? And what do they perceive as fake news? I think that's a thing that many people in the West are very interested about, because, of course, here in the West, all we hear is that most of the fake news is coming from Russia. So how is that working in the country itself?
I'm not sure if I'm exactly in the position to sort of give a very, you know, elaborate view on that, because that was not something I've worked with. But sort of generally speaking, I would say that the phenomenon of fake news in Russia is very much connected to the workings of the state propaganda and what you hear on the state-owned TV primarily. There was, for instance, one of the most memorable moments was certainly the story on the crucified little boy in East Ukraine. And I believe that was 2015, or around that time when the war in Donetsk and Luhansk was taking place, which turned out to be completely fake. And the woman who was telling this story turned out to just, you know, completely make it up. There was no crucified little boy. Nonetheless, you know, one of the main TV channels sort of ran this story. And as far as I remember, they never took it back. So the viewers never got to hear that was all completely made up. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example, you know, probably the most memorable example of fake news. And you mainly connect it to the ways in which the very much in the same way the Russian state is trying to, you know, give a particular version of reality that is often simply not grounded in facts.
Do you think that everything which is happening right now, that there might be some positive development within the Russian society, I would say maybe not overthrow Putin, but to at least get some change in the current political system? Or do you think this is something which will take decades to be fulfilled? Do you think it's going to be soon, or is it going to be like within 20, 30 years?
Well, you know, there is something that definitely gives me hope. And I think working with these communities, especially with the youngest of them, Doxa, the student community in Moscow, really gave me a very different picture of what matters to, you know, the Gen Z generation in Russia right now. This is a very different discussion around, you know, around democracy, around feminism, around queer people, the LGBTQ people. That is a very, very different rhetoric, which we don't very much see, because, you know, people who are 20 and 25 are just not represented in the Russian media. And that is why what docs are doing is so important. Of course, this is a minority. This is an urban minority, moreover. And you could always argue that they are, you know, they are marginalized and they are not really representing the future vector. But this is, you know, obviously it's the minority that will be running the show. And looking at this kind of progressive rhetoric that's just completely normal in those younger milieus, you know, I think that is really that one thing that gives me a lot of hope. Again, they're not visible and they're not very much represented. And what we see, moreover, is that they're very much prosecuted right now, unfortunately. Now, I wish that they will not end up in prison, but that is why we don't know. But actually being there and listening and hearing what they're saying and what they're doing and to what extent they're actually willing to have that voice heard, I think gave me a very optimistic picture for the future.
Right. And how do you see the future of the anarchist movement within Russia? No matter what happens with Navalny this year, how do you think are they going to evolve?
I mean, I'm really not in the position to sort of make an analysis of Russian anarchists. I only very briefly worked with them, but you do see interesting things taking place. I mean, as much as they have been on the radar of the repressive apparatus of the state, and they have been prosecuted, and there have been criminal cases against them. You also see new alternative media by the anarchists popping up, and Avtonom, of course, is the old one, but there is another one which is called Molokko Plus, for instance, which appeared as I was doing my research, which very much continues that old tradition of the older anarchist media within the country, and which also largely attracts that kind of younger pool of participants from the anarchist side. So the traditions are still there, of course. The interest is still there. Russia does have a very long, obviously, anarchist tradition, and the classics of anarchism tend to come in from Russia in large numbers.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I don't see it dying out at all. I think it will be very much a part of the political landscape, even though very much an underground landscape.
All right. As to your plans for the future, as I can sense from our conversations, you are very much politically involved. What are your plans on academic and political stage in your next years, in the next years to come? What are you planning to do with the next decade, for example?
You know, every time something like a new wave of protests in Russia happens, I am sitting here in Stockholm and thinking, what am I doing here? Why am I not there? I'm like itching to do something and, to also be there. And, I do have a background in journalism. And of course, I was involved to some extent in activism. It's difficult to look at those things from far away. So I do feel that connection very much still being there with Russia, even though I have not been I have not been living in Russia for 8 years now. In that sense, I hope that, I will be still able to contribute in one way or another to what's happening there. But also, I think, building bridges and building understanding between, say, the West and Russia, which is lacking, which is extremely insufficient at this point. And I think I would, at this point of my life, would like to sort of get the two sides, understand each other a bit better, while at the same time making myself useful in Russia wherever I can, which is becoming more difficult because, the pandemic has not really helped us to stay connected with things happening in foreign countries, even though if this foreign country is ironically your home country. Yeah. So I, at this point, feel a little bit disconnected. I would love to restore that link and see what I can do. Because, Russia is a fascinating place. In 20 years, I'm not sure how Sweden will look in 20 years, but I know that Russia will probably be a completely different country in that time, and that just makes it so fascinating to follow and to analyze.
That is very correct. Nobody knows, as we say in Russian, you can't understand Russia with the mind. So there will be some changes. We just don't know what they are. However, maybe for the last question is something which I encounter a lot here in Belgium. There's a certain fear of Russians, which of course is has been cultivated for many years in the West. There is something to be said about Russophobia within the European community. And I always have a very hard time convincing people over here that not all Russians are alcoholic warmongers who are racist and beat their women. So if you could try to convince typically a fearful European of that Russians are not that bad, what would be your pitch? How would you sell that?
I would say take the opportunity and use that e-visa that Russia introduced, I believe, starting this year, 21. You can now spend, I think, a week in the country just applying online for the visa, which used to be a horrible procedure before. Watch it with your own eyes, make up your own mind, and that there is no better way to actually experience and understand what is going on in the country.
Oh, well, I'm glad you said that. Kirill, I would like to very much thank you for your time. We will also, of course, post the link to your thesis. So for those people interested, they'll be able to read it for themselves. It was a very fascinating read. It was a very fascinating interview. I'd like to thank you for your time, and hopefully we'll get to meet one day in person. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good day.